Hi, I'm Malcolm Hawker, and this is the CDO Matters podcast, the show where I dig deep into the strategic insights, best practices, and practical recommendations that modern data leaders need to help their organizations become truly data-driven. Tune in for thought-provoking discussions with data, IT, and business leaders to learn about the CDO matters that are top of mind for today's chief data officers. Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, whenever you are, wherever you are. I'm Malcolm.
It's good afternoon here, Malcolm, and good morning to you. I think if you're in Florida, yeah. So yeah.
It is. So, but we do record these, of course, and people are replying back whenever but yes, good morning to me here in Florida, and of course, good afternoon in the UK, and good day, good evening, good whenever to all of our listeners and viewers and subscribers. I'm Malcolm. I'm the host of CDO Matters podcast, and joined today by the esteemed Eddie Short.
Esteemed Eddie Short, yeah. Well,
yes.
Thank you.
Well, you are. We're gonna talk about your background in a little bit. But I've known you, Eddie, for probably 2 years now. We trade a lot of content on LinkedIn. We comment on each other's posts. I think we've had a couple of one-on-one sessions in the past. I look through past guests of the podcast, and it's like, I can't believe I haven't talked to Eddie. So I'm glad we're getting a chance to be together today and have a chat. A couple of data nerds like ourselves. You've got a long history in the world of data and analytics. You've been a CDO multiple times. You've been a consultant. Tell us just kind of a little bit about your professional evolution, Eddie, and where you are now.
Yeah, so very quickly, started life as a chemical engineer for Mobil Oil, which is now ExxonMobil. Worked for them for 4 years. I'd say one of the Kurtzworth feature of my life back in early in the 90s, it was like, if you wanted to get involved in our large SAP program, you need to have 20 years in the business or become a consultant. So I went and became a consultant. So I worked for KPMG the first time, did a lot of the classical end user computing stuff, and then it became early days of the dot-com era. So I became remorphed as an e-business, e-commerce strategy consultant, and did a number of things for them. And then I was poached by what is Sema Group, which is now Atos, to basically help build their UK e-business practice. Built that up in the late 90s. I had a couple of attempts to make some money myself in the dot-com era, failed miserably. And in 2001, I ended up at Ernst & Young as Ernst & Young Consulting was bought by Capgemini. So when I arrived, it was CGUI, Capgemini, Ernst & Young. And although I'd done, I mean, I built my first AI system or expert system at university in 1989. To design distillation columns as an engineer, and I did a number of things around data, but I went mainly full-time into data in the early 2000s because I was a director in their technology strategy practice. 18 months in, they asked me to, a number of us, to do strategies for what we were going to do, and I got data. And they seemed to like the strategy, and they said, would you like to run the business? And I inherited initially 6 data migration guides. 6 data, and they were some crazy people. And we went basically back through the value chain over the next 2 or 3 years to build out, you'd say now, what we called it at the time, business information management. Because I picked up quite early on some unstructured guys and we did document and records management. I built a thing which is seminal to this. 2004, I became a vice president. And I built a point of view called Creating the Intelligent Enterprise. And then originally it was from business intelligence to intelligent business. But my boss at the time said, Eddie, half our clients are in the public sector. If you call it intelligent business, they wouldn't get it at all. So let's call it intelligent enterprise. and that was, I would call it then an early data and information strategy methodology. But yeah, we were doing structured, unstructured data. We called it mashups in those days, not big data, bringing together different types of data. And I went from being UK to being global leader for Capgemini, what is now their data and analytics practice. We largely served CIOs. And at that time, I remember you were probably a Gartner analyst at that time. It's kind of saying in various Gartner meetings and trying to get into the magic quadrant for services and saying,
oh, yes,
Can't we get a different title for this? Because, you know, CIOs, they don't do data. And actually data, we're trying to exploit data and turn it into information. Can't we be the CIOs? Of course, that was a futile conversation, but I didn't really like working for CIOs. And at the time, they weren't making it. It was kind of a virtual global practice. It wasn't a global business. So at that point, I was approached, and that became my first global, what you call it now, CDO role. But I went to British American Tobacco. Never smoked in my life. Company grew with people who smoked, but yeah, never smoked in my life. But it was one of the top 10 companies in the UK. And I joined what was then called Business Services, and I was helped them to build a global business. They were a classic multinational with lots of reporting. And the only thing they had really centrally was a Hyperion financial management system.
Oh, I know it well.
And we spent over 3 or 4 years, about £100 million, not all new, but I basically consolidated a bunch of investments, presented to the board, sponsored by the COO, and we worked with finance, marketing, operations, supply chain, as well as IT to build this infrastructure. I remember that little SAP thing. So we did great things. And our global CFO at the time said, we want to do global SAP. We actually had 7 instances. And I said to him in a classic Eddie way, why do you want to do that? What's the benefit? And he said, well, everybody else is doing global SAP.
By the way, they still are. They still are. I had many conversations last week at the Gartner event in London where that is still a thing. It's still a huge focus. Consultants making bags of money on SAP consolidations.
And I'll just pause for breath there. There's kind of 2 things. In that journey, so at the time, this program was priced at $500 million. I said, we can to CFO, I said, we can do everything you want if we just basically extend what we've done on the BI data program. Not the answer they wanted to hear. I went over to Waldorf, headquarters of SAP, and gave them the benefit of my wisdom, which was, why is this HANA thing at the back end of everything? Because at the time, I kind of get to this point, all of us data guys are sitting there at the exhaust of everything to do with process. And we're picking up all this exhaust stuff. And effectively, as we spend tens, if not hundreds of millions, we're now cloud-based systems, actually reassembling that exhaust data to tell you what happened. But going back to my old enough days, when I first was taught about computers, it was input, process, output. And actually, input is data. But nobody was thinking about input data. And kind of that became part of this intelligent enterprise concept of kind of how do you make the data part of the input to become, I would call it predictive by design.
How much what you described, though, how much of what you described as data as exhaust is really because of the dominance of ERP in the manufacturing space? Tendency to look at data through a manufacturing lens, a pipeline lens, this linear begin and end.
Yeah, well, exactly that, Malcolm. I think you're spot on. But what my construct was about intelligent enterprise was, you know, say it's people, process, technology, but it was simply, actually, it's really process defines technology. People are the business case. How many people can we save? And data is kind of the forgotten child, which at the end is like, shit, we need some reports to tell us what's going on. And it's kind of like bolt that in at the end. But that was kind of this process. And when you actually think about it, having done my MBA and all these things, it's kind of like, well, it's this process thing. As you say, it's a 19th century construct for how you basically scale a manufacturing business. And yeah, I worked in BAT at the time, but now increasingly in the UK, it's 85% of the economy is services. In the US, maybe it's 82, 83. It's not fit for purpose model. And when we super forward ahead, you know, you think about multi-channel, omni-channel. If you try to map out process in the traditional way and design systems, this does not work. You know, basically, right. We have different channels. We have phone, we have apps, we have web, we have social. And what you're talking about in a modern system is journeys of customers through all those different channels. And actually, that zooms you into, you really need data-driven or data-enabled model. And you often increasingly need AI to work out which is the right routing through that. And actually, you don't need process. What you actually need is kind of real-time orchestration You need, for some regulated industries, you need to be able to spit out what were the steps, those process steps, to tell the regulator how you actually got from A to B. But process is that kind of structure. And what's happened in many businesses is go back to the start of my career, Michael Hammer, re-engineering the corporation. That was all about, let's obliterate processes. But actually, that was the genesis of the ERP revolution, where largely what we did was hard-coded processes. And we did some automation and some efficiency. And in the new world, we can genuinely obliterate processes. So my construct now is kind of zooming forward. It's kind of people, data, AI with process and technology, as I call them, second order. The process is basically you've got to have some things in the system, and technology, clearly you've got to have it. But for most businesses, for most organizations, technology is the table stakes. It's not a source of competitive advantage.
You touched on something. I'd love to continue to drill on this and maybe take the entire time to do it, because I think you're touching on something that is really foundational here. This manufacturing centric approach, let's just loosely say that. The artifacts that it creates, I think, are ill suited for a digital world. And this is basically what you're saying. I would argue that how we approach data management is a reflection of that manufacturing-centric approach, and it doesn't work very well. I would argue governance, for sure, is a reflection of that. I work with a lot of incredibly smart people, and we have discussions about governance as a control mechanism. And in a manufacturing world, it most certainly is, because you have specifications, you have guidelines, you have standard operating procedures, and these are the controls. It has to be here, and it has to be here. Otherwise, you're going to produce a product that is suboptimal. And I think that's been applied to data. And I think that does make sense to a certain degree. But if you're an Uber or a Netflix or one of these digital natives that has a completely different operating model, you don't really operate. You don't work that way. Yeah. And you don't and you don't need a governance function, because governance is inherent to kind of what you do. Okay. So you were at KPMG. You had this aha moment.
Yeah.
That is aligned to what you are now calling the intelligent enterprise. You move from KPMG into a couple CDO roles at Aon, Virgin Media. Did you apply some of the things?
Basically, to your point about governance, actually, as we passing, when I was at KPMG, one of my other little things was risk and performance, two sides of the same data. I was not a popular partner when I went into one bank and said, why are we doing this same project five times, to the lead partner? And he said, what do you mean? I said, well, we've got a program in the front office. We've got a program in the middle office. We've got a program in compliance, one in risk, and we've got something in IT building stuff. They're all basically solving the same problem. And he said, if we basically collapse these into one project, which will cost basically about the equivalent of two of the five, we will do everything the customer needs. And it's like, but that's not what the customer, we're doing what the customer wants. I said, we should be doing what the customer needs. We're meant to be advisors. It's like, this is not what they want to hear. It's like, but when you actually think about it from a data perspective, certainly in terms of data protection and data governance, the data you need to treat your customers fairly, to know your customers, if the same data you actually need to manage regulators is the same data you need to market and sell. And if you're basically doing this pipeline and thinking, not in the linear process of I need a compliance process, I need a marketing process, I need a sales process, but actually we can do many things. You can say risk is two sides of the same coin, and you can, to use an analogy, buy one, get one free almost. You still have to have the outputs that are different. And so zoom that forward. Yeah, I took that to Aon, where I redesigned their data business. I was the CDO for Aon Hewitt, which was the people data, people analytics. So I was at the vanguard of the creation of people analytics in 2015, 2016. We collected all sorts of data, pay data, assessment data, psychometrics data. And that was a $300-400 million business. But one of the things we had was, it was a survey business. And clients said to us, this is terrible. The surveys are awful. You should be paying us to fill in the surveys. In the end, early stages, two data scientists, Google TensorFlow, we re-engineered the survey process so we could just suck data with client permission out of their workday, SuccessFactors, and all these other systems, and normalize it ourselves, take all the shit away from them. and spit them back the answers. And suddenly, with after two people in a pilot over 3 months, within a year, we've got increased net promoter score, better value, and we're actually starting to drive more intelligent insights. Also important is people. When you start to combine all this people data, you can start to look at, you know, what drives people, what motivates people. Now, sadly for us in Aon Hewitt, our main client was the CHRO, not the people you need to do to manage people, unfortunately. Right. They are a compliance function. But when you sell to the business, you can look at what the drives the motivation. So as an example, in a private banking situation, actually with a couple of US banks, we kind of say, we've got all this data about you. And we sat with the COO of this division, and he said, well, my problem is I've got some star bankers. Everybody else is median or below. And he said, is there anything you can do to help us look at who are the median bankers that we can move up? Combining all the driver psychometric data that we got from all these different things, we can start to build models, which are not AI. Well, they are AI, but basically say, effectively stratify your people and say, well, actually, with the right training and development, these people can be moved to 80% of the star banker. These can be improved. And in the nicest possible way, these people probably can't be. That was a nice, interesting service. Zoom forward to Telefonica O2. And so that's a $10 billion business. We came Virgin Media O2. And this is a seminal moment for me. I went in there initially as a consultant, as an independent, to do a data strategy. And after 2 months, I'd done the data strategy. I'd worked with the chief commercial officer, chief marketing officer, chief operating officer, CFO, presented to the CEO. And he said to me, this guy called Mark Evans, he said to me, Eddie, great strategy, but I've seen five of these, and I've only been here for 7 years, a CFO and then CEO.
Oh my.
They've all failed. And I look around in our world as quite a few people who are looking on their CVs who were at Telefonica in those periods. I'm going, all right, their trading has been, but all failed. They said, well, you know, what's your confidence in doing this? I said, well, I've done it 3 or 4 times. Da, 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 da. But it's like, well, but you're a consultant. We need somebody who can deliver this. Well, then they came down. Would you deliver it? You've got to come on board as an employee again. So I came on board as an employee. What we did, and what I did initially was mapped out this journey, and I asked for £5 million, about $6 million, and they said, "Well, you've got no chance of doing this journey with $6 million." I said, "Well, yeah, you've got no confidence in this journey. So, what I'll do is I need $5 million for 6 months. Let me go away, and we'll work on a number of the use cases, and we worked on things like basic personalization, churn management. Interesting in telecoms, and particularly mobile, the key message was still, how many ads, how many new contracts are we going to get?
Yeah.
Some basic things around stratifying the customer base and identifying what we call red customers. These are customers we need to get rid of. They cost us money. Every time there's a contract renewal, they're getting a discount. They're asking for more. They're asking for free. They're asking, threatening to leave. Da, da, da. The concept of changing people's mindsets to some people we can get rid of. Because actually,
heresy. Yeah, firing customers, that's heresy. Yeah.
Gold customers who actually make us $2,000 customer lifetime value, silver customers and bronze customers. Let's move these guys, because actually we'll drive more revenue and more profit and actually save money by stopping trying to keep these guys who basically are exploiting the system. It's kind of mindset shift. And after 6 months, funnily enough, they sign up to a 3-year program for $20-30 million a year to deliver what we call at the time omni-channel decisioning, or in fact, we called it marketing speak, campaign management and journey orchestration. But what it turned into was a revenue and customer transformation. And me, the CDO, was the senior responsible owner, dotted into the board and the CEO of, you are the owner of this revenue customer transformation. So on one side, we built a Pega-centric platform powered with Telium, with some data enrichment from a company called IntentHQ, which are used by a lot of the telcos and banks. Link that into our migration from legacy to cloud-based. We had a Teradata system. We were trying to migrate off that to a cloud-based environment. But what we also did, we basically built an agile business model where we brought together marketeers, technologists, salespeople, and customer service to re-engineer the way we worked and the people worked in order to exploit that. So we were going to be doing sprints and weekly team meetings and looking at how we're going to orchestrate things. So it was a business, complete business transformation. Fast forward to 2021, we merged in the UK with Virgin Media to form Virgin Media O2, the second largest telecoms business in the UK. And at that point, in this new platform, we had about 500,000 customers on our new platform. Some guys from Virgin Media saying, we're building a new digital business. What we're going to do over the next 3 years is basically build this new platform, and we're going to fold the business into this platform. This new platform, the answer is Google GCP, and we're going to put some technologies around it, but we're going to build this state-of-the-art digital platform. And I'm looking, and they said, we like what you've been doing, but frankly, it's old school. It's old school. This is new. Suffice to say, I survived about another 6 months and then left the building. Zoom forward 2 years later, and I'll come back to why we've done that last 2 years. My platform's now running 13.5 million customers, despite the fact that all development was cut off when I left. So it was never properly finished. I won't tell you how much they spent, but it was somewhere between 100 million and 1 billion pounds.
On the GCP migration, you mean?
GCP, but all, yeah. Not just the GCP migration, but all the new platforms.
Okay. Yeah.
Suffice to say, everybody, over the next 2 years, they spent hundreds of millions. Subsequently, everybody's been fired because, yes, they've done the migration of the data to GCP. Value creation, nil point. Business change, nil point. And that's because basically it's like, we're going to build a better mousetrap, and you guys are going to use it because it's so good. It's so great. It's so fantastic. It's like, everybody's going, but what's in it for me? What's in it for me? It's this kind of epic fail. And now that kind of takes you to where we first started talking, because in parallel to that, I thought, I've been talking for time about doing a doctoral program. I need to codify what I've been doing all this time. And so I signed up to do a Doctor of Business Administration in 2021, which is kind of a professional PhD. The theory goes, it's not an MBA. It's not a top. They spend a year teaching you to be a researcher, but you're really, what they're trying to do is combine. You've got 25 years of business experience. We want to bolt on, effectively, half the research that you would do in a PhD, but bring that professional and research thing together to give you a PhD level, but a more practical view of that. And I started to look at the exam question of how do you deliver sustained, and I added in then sustainable, so you can pick the ESG green circular economy piece, competitive advantage with data analytics and AI. I add in AI, but then really I describe AI as just sophisticated analytics. So it's kind of data analytics.
I completely agree, by the way.
And I'm looking at that, and so day one, I kind of they start saying, these are, this is what teacher research. I'm starting looking for all the research papers, and I'm looking for all the luminaries that we know, and I'm not going to name but the luminaries who are writing in Forbes and HBR and writing great articles about fantastic work with data and analytics. And quite a few of these are US professors. And then I'm looking for where are their research papers that they put in? And it's like, again, none. Zero academic research. I was like, this is kind of like doesn't compute. I'm going, And what I found is that the people who've done actually the academic research are mainly actually in Europe and in Asia. And there's still not an awful lot, because when you've been in the analyst space, the number of real definitive pieces of how much value you create with data is pretty appalling, given how long we've been doing this. But there is some research. And what research there is based on centrally a thing called resource-based theory, which is a strategic theory, kind of an alter ego to, everybody knows Michael Porter's competitive strategy and spy forces and value chain, kind of externally facing, the environment you find yourself, your power of customers, suppliers, etc. Resource-based theory developed in the US really in the 80s and 90s. It's about how do you build a competitive capability inside? What resource-based theory says, for something to be a real competitive advantage to you, it's got to be valuable. Well, no brainer. It's got to be rare. It means, kind of different to what other people have got to be done. And then the flip side of rare, it's got to be inimitable, difficult to copy. And then fundamentally, it's got to be embedded in the organization. So, and when I look at all the people trying to train businesses, and I've given you my Virgin Media 2 one, They're focusing on, in the nicest possible, in data and AI, GCP and other technologies, which are neither rare nor difficult to copy. So you've got to have the technology, as I said, you've got to have it, but you've got rare and difficult to copy. You've got to focus on the value and embed it in the organization. So you see in that example, no embedding in the organization, a massive organizational resistance. So lots of expenditure here, no benefit. And then there are some other theories that we can come into, but it's kind of like looking at that as a basis. And so I'm looking and then saying, well, when you do research, we're talking about what we talk about day-to-day big problems, but when you're trying to get a doctoral thesis signed off, you have to solve a narrow problem. So yours truly then works on the basis of, okay, this resource-based theory, they've done all these things, right? What have they haven't they looked at? And they hadn't looked at the role of a CDO in this. You know, they basically looked at, you know, what data do people have? How much money do they get? What's the culture? Because they're data literacy. But they hadn't actually looked at the roles and responsibility contribution of the CDO. So that's the bit that I took on. And I started the research in anger last year. And I conducted some surveys with the support of the Data Leaders Group, nice international data organization. We got about 100 CDOs to fill it in. And then the results came in, which was a bit like what you would see that, yes, we can start to see strong correlation between data analytics and AI and company performance. And then you actually look at, there isn't a lot of positive correlation between the contribution of CDOs and positive company performance in that model. We're just not hitting the bars because too many of us are focusing on the VM question of the data pipelines, data mesh, data tools, which again, as I'm saying, you have to have, but they're not focusing, as we've seen on debates, half of them can't even describe what the value is. I mean, my question to you guys is like, why don't you just quit? Because if you can't describe the value of what you're doing, you shouldn't be in the job. And they're not doing anything on the organization. And that's basically why we're failing.
Well, gosh, okay. So much to unpack there. So much to unpack. My first really meaningful question would be, did you ever meet Sir Richard?
No, I didn't. I never met him because I was in the Telefonica bit and kind of stepped back. We were like Virgin Media and Virgin Media too. They pay about a few million pounds a year to license the brand name. Some involvement, but I wasn't.
I saw Virgin. I was like, hey, you know, maybe he's on the list to go to space with Sir Richard at some point in the future. Okay. That was me being glib, but man. Okay. So much to unpack. Where to start? But the GCP field of dreams at a previous employer, and we don't need to pick on the previous employer because there are plenty of examples. I've had multiple guests on this podcast who've explained the exact same scenario. Rene Laudy, who was the CDO of Hitachi Vantara, explained the exact same thing, shared the exact same anecdote. I've had other conversations with other CDOs where they've said the exact same thing, where they have tried the field of dreams, spent literally hundreds of millions of dollars to get to the exact same point that you just previously described. So we don't need to pick on any one company because it keeps happening over and over again. Why? Like, we know these things, these galactic, gigantic initiatives are high risk. We know when we focus on technology, it's a bad idea. We know when we can't articulate business value and we can't tie the spend to specific business. We know these things, but we keep doing this stuff. Like, why?
Well, I think if you're in a bunch of industries, say financial services, telecoms, retail, you kind of know these things, but then you see Amazon, you see Google, you see Meta, you see Microsoft, and particularly with Amazon, it's like the Pac-Man. It's a technology-driven business, but it's eating my lunch. So as much as I know, it's like they kind of, it's like rabbit in the headlights. I need to try and copy them, and they're doing the latest technology. But they are, you'd say, they're the classic digital natives. And what I find is that you can import some people from Amazon or Google, but it's like red blood cells. It's a virus, and the white blood cells resist massively. So you kind of you have to think differently, and you say it's kind of statement of the obvious, but people revert to that. It's like, as I gave you the VMO2, and we'll build a new digital business. We'll effectively create our own Amazon. We'll create our own, and therefore we need the people, the technology to basically do that. And then everything else will be great. It's also a way we actually fund and manage these things. So there's a lot of challenges, I would say, in the finance world, because these guys are looking to say, when can I capitalize an investment? And looking at technology, we capitalize an investment when it's switched on. It's kind of like, that's only the beginning.
It's not the value delivery, it's just on. Yeah.
And they're suddenly saying, yeah, right, you're a year in, we're capitalizing it, you haven't got any benefits. It's like, well, we didn't say we were going to get any benefits until a year in. It's like, but you've chosen to go that way. So there's kind of that other mentality of you've got to get the technology. The technology is an asset, and all this other stuff is intangible. We can't, we got to expense that. Well, we're not used to doing that. So it's kind of like,
use or lose. That was every year CapEx, I had use or lose, and it creates these perverted incentives to go buy stuff.
Yeah.
and then
there is this culture, which I've seen has been a partner in the Big Four. And it's particularly acute in this country that I live in, the UK. It's not so bad in the US, but it's like we have developed a culture of risk avoidance as opposed to risk management. And that is in main some way to do with the over-engineering of the finance capability. Mm. And so you've got, whereas you might, in the US, you still do a lot of experiments, fail fast, all those things. It's still a bit alien over here, and people are not good at managing it. And then you also look at, there are many things at fault. The Shrek firms, the headhunters, they haven't woken up to this. They're still, and it comes back to what I was saying 20 years ago when I talked to Gartner. By calling it the chief data officer function, it just to a CEO sounds like some technical thing, right? It's like so they're going to build some tools. I get that. And I can understand that. Going to buy some tools. I've heard about this OpenAI tool. I've heard about this Google tool. They can buy that, and then we're going to be great. It's like, so even though you kind of institutionally know, it's still like the people at the top, they need simple storytelling messages. And one of the massive failures in the CDO community, and I say, because I'm old enough and ugly enough, so I said 15, 20 years ago, I was known as Mr. Spock by a lot of people because I'd be bringing my data, bringing my evidence, bringing my fact base. And Mr. Spock, you're beating us to death with logic again. It's kind of like, we get that. But secondly, the CEO wants a story, you know? And they need a story. And actually, you know, you look at most boards, they get the core finance numbers, but most of the conversation is still not really data driven at the board level. It's kind of still storytelling. And so we've got to get with that program. And you know, when you look at the CFOs and others, they've gone through 20 years of leadership programs. We've gone through 20 years. People have gone through 20 years of, all right, data mesh training, MDM training. I've got to use some Python. I've got some SQL, but they haven't learned the leadership skills, which means they can't communicate and operate at that executive committee level. You start to see the same thing on another side. That suddenly CISOs are really important, but people who can talk about cyber and risk have suddenly been whacked three levels up the organization. It's like, we need a CISO, but we don't understand what they're talking about.
But I'm afraid of all of our data getting into the wrong hands. So let's fund this.
So that's what I see. It's kind of this leadership challenge, and there has been this jockeying for position of where do you sit, and kind of I look at the banks, and then kind of CDO is a second class person in the COO organization, secondary to a lot of CIOs, CTOs. It's just because we've kind of got to the limit of our incompetence, as they would say. And people then revert to, I'll need some pipelines, I need some tools, da, 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 da. And as opposed to really just go and talk to the business, you know, that's what I said, the power of Excel. Even with Excel, you can do some great prototyping, everybody can understand it. And then it's like saying, well, if we're going to take this a bit further, we might need something like Tableau or Qlik or Power BI. And then behind that, we go a bit further, we prove some more value. We need a more sophisticated data capability behind there. But so it's taking people on a journey is what's going to go back to my Telefonica thing, the 5 million to do the basics churn and blah, 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 before the 50, 100 million omni-channel decisioning, because you've taken people on a journey. And that's All those things, I kind of just call it, it's kind of management 101, leadership training, development. And we're just missing that from a lot of the people in our world. And so I then come back to trying to codify that in a doctorate, which is hard because I want to solve big problems. But then, right, as you probably touched on, yeah, I then created, well, so how do you do this? And I've created 7 habits of, I think I called it originally the highly effective CDO, stolen with pride from Stephen Covey. But I call it 7 habits of the highly effective data analytics and data-enabled AI-powered business. So it's kind of, because you're trying to say capabilities that you need to develop, and they're not, I need to be this, that, and that other AI or this data tool, but it's the capabilities that, and that comes back to my research and just say things that the business leaderships will understand.
So let's go back to something you said a while back. You've been using the phrase data-driven, and yeah, as it goes, I'm fine with that. Yeah. As a kind of a pithy marketing kitschy, I get it, right? I think I understand the underlying meaning of using data to make decisions, and I'm okay with it. But I think we use that phrase a lot, and yeah, I think it's to the point where often it lacks meaning. And you gave a very specific example of that, where you were questioning, for lack of a better word, academic research in the field of data and analytics.
Yeah.
And this is something that I stumbled on while I was at Gartner, which is we talk a lot about being data driven, right? Yeah. We data people talk a big game.
Yeah.
It's interesting because we almost talk about it like it's somebody else's deliverable.
Yeah.
Right. Like it's not ours. That's what they need to do. We're already data driven because it's in our title. Right. And we're data, yep, people, and we get it. But that's something that they go and need to go and do. But what I stumbled on is when you peel the onion on some of the data that we have on our own performance,
yeah,
what you find is really, I hate to use the word shocking because that sounds like clickbaity and like just too incendiary. But what you find is that there's really not a lot of data there. I'll give you an, yep, example. Gartner does an annual CDO survey, and I would argue, as surveys go, this one's pretty good. They had, the last time they did it, they had an N well over 700, yeah, and pretty darn good, and came up with a stat that says only 44% of CDOs feel like they're delivering meaningful value to their organizations.
Yeah.
But who are they asking? CDOs.
Yeah.
And what question are they asking? Well, value. Like, okay. So first of all, the Dunning-Kruger effect is very real.
Yeah.
We like to think we are a lot better at just about everything than we really actually are. So the 44% is a self-assessment. And if that's a self-assessment, in actuality, it's probably a lot lower than that.
Yeah.
And let's press on value a little bit. Oh, okay. Do we have metrics around value? Can you actually say, oh, well, I do, or I am, or I'm not. I'm delivering business outcomes. I put money in the bank. No, we don't, because data people have no data on the value of data. We know this when every time we ask if you can actually quantify it, answer is no. So in one simple little stat that is being used widely to describe our performance, and I could keep going, right? I could list for an hour. I could talk about studies and surveys that aren't real studies and where the surveys are vendor commissioned.
Yeah.
Right. Which are specious from the get-go.
Absolutely.
But that aside, right? There's not a lot of real data here, right? Like I had to defend a master's thesis, but you know, and I had to defend my conclusions. I had to, yeah, show data. I had to show real, and there's not a lot of that in what we do.
And yeah, it's not that hard. I mean, and this is the crazy thing. It's I started in the era of business intelligence, and then it's kind of like, yeah, we had to report, we were helping people report the performance of their business. Come back in there, working at KPMG in 2011-12, the data science thing, machine learning arrived. All these people who are suddenly PhD physicists and maths basically told us, you guys are old school. You don't know what you're talking about. And suddenly we create these new analytics things where they didn't measure. They were trying to do cool, really cool stuff. But those are the people who stuck along with the kind of BI. It's kind of like, I'm in the believing of practicing what you preach, and you have to measure your performance. Now, precisely to your point, at the same time, there were lots of other people doing data monetization. We could sell our data, yeah. I describe that mainly as like panning for gold, where there's an awful lot of shit and one or two nuggets, and often quite a lot, hardly any nuggets. But
that assumes the lawyers will even give you a pan. That assumes your lawyers will even give you a pen.
Lots of people spend a lot of money trying to monetize cell data. But I look at this leadership thing, and I'll give you the thing which we did at Telefonica, and I just do consistently, which is you sit down as a leader with other leaders, and you say, right, okay, we want to do this personalization solution. We want to do this supply chain solution. We want to do this financial solution, right? You can't do this without me. I'm working with you. We're working together. Our teams are working together. We get a combined business case, and then we have a leadership discussion. Are you 30% of this, 70% of this, 60% of this? But you get a leader's agreement. You rock up to the CFO and say, we're going to deliver 20 million a year per annum, annualized, to the bottom line. We're both claiming 50% of that. So, and that when you delivered it, and everybody looks back, we've delivered 25. Okay, great. Oh, we've only delivered 15. But you've got evidence that says, we know you can argue about whether it's 55, but actually, right, okay, I've delivered 12 and a half of that 25. That was my measure. And by going to the board with, I've got the director of customer service, I've got the financial controller, I've got the director of sales, we've together have combined this business case, we're signed up to deliver it, and then 6 months, 12 months, 18 months down the track, we've delivered it, we've measured it, we've measured the outcome. As leaders, we share the benefits. And then that's all you have to do to measure the results. And the organization as a whole is a success. But that's my point. It's this leadership, lack of leadership skills and ability to basically share and negotiate, which is lacking, because then I built a dashboard and it said, okay, well we built this and we built some data products. Great, fantastic. But it's like, who's using them? Who's measuring the value of that? You've got to have other leaders. As I was going to say, one of my habits is you have to be the ultimate servant leader. You cannot deliver any value on your own unless you work for a pure data business. You work right. for who just sells data like Cantor Research or maybe Bloomberg. But for 99% of you, your success is predicated on doing something with somebody else. Your data plus their function delivers this value to the customer, or this compliance saving, or this cost adjustment. And again, as leaders, you agree. And that's, for me, that again, that's my point about, I come back to my VRIO, resource-based theory, yeah? If in doubt, we can't measure the value, and we're not doing the change management, what do we default to? The technology, which is not rare or difficult to copy. And that's institutionalized failure, but that's what's happening. It's challenging, it's worrying, it's disturbing. And I'm writing about this, and I just feel like I'm constantly bad cop out there.
You're not the only one. You're not alone.
People are afraid to ask for help. I mean, I think I'm just here. I'm now back to being an independent. I've got a lot of gray hair. I'm here to help the C-level. That includes the CEOs, but also includes CIOs and CDOs with how do you drive performance with data and analytics. I'm not going to be your guru on Python. I'm not going to be your guru on the subtle nuances of whether GPT-4o is better than Gemini 1.5. But I kind of understand all that stuff. But it's really, how do you get that value and the organizationally embedded? You guys have got the technology bit coming out of you, but I'm going to challenge it because I understand all that. But it's bringing it all together, which is really where what we've got to make a difference on. Because fundamentally, we're in this... I would call it a crossing the Grand Canyon moment. We had Jeffrey Moore crossing the chasm. I look at what's happening out there right now. The level of volatility, uncertainty, complexity in the world. Uncertainty, wars, interest rates, economics. Then you add in the sustainability, green, net zero agenda. And then you add on top of that the technology, but particularly AI and generative AI. And my simple expression is that most chief executives cannot cross this chasm alone. They need support. They need assistance. They're not getting it from a lot of strat firms. It's not about PowerPointing this to death. It's about people who can actually help you build the bridge and actually help you get across the bridge. And that's what I'm about in trying to help people, is bringing all that experience with some research and being that person who just says counterintuitively, that doesn't work, and just standing up. And I'll give you I know we're running out of time, but my when we'd merged together as VMO2, my former boss, Mark Evans, didn't become the CEO. He stood down, and the guy from VM got the CEO role. And Mark said to me, he said, Eddie, I really appreciated working with you because you were the only person in my leadership team who ever told me I was wrong. Whoever challenged me, everybody else just goes, yes, Mark, whatever you want, we'll deliver. And you, the honesty, transparency, and getting the story across. And I think it comes back to what I was saying earlier. Too much happens at the board and the executive level, which is still great storytelling. And we rock up with our data and evidence, but we can't tell good stories. We can't operate that leadership level. We've got to cross our chasm as data in the data community to be leaders, truly leaders. And we need to bring that evidence to the guys who are just sitting there with the one-liners. And there's a great book that I recommend everybody to read, which is called May Contain Lies. It's written by a guy called Professor Alex Edmonds of London Business School. And it pops the challenge. You know, we pick up many different ones. I mentioned the American academics in our space who didn't write any academic papers on the subject. But the easy one, which everybody can talk about, is Malcolm Gladwell. You know, 10,000 hours gets you mastery in any subject. You know, that's a classic one which went through boards in the late 2000s. Everybody's going, yeah, 10,000, wow, fantastic. It wasn't based, it was based on a study of a conservatory, basically a music study in Germany, where they just happened to know that people who were in the conservatory had done many thousands of hours of training. But there wasn't any, it was one paper which wasn't even talking about 10,000 hours of mastery. And from that, we built an entire, because Gladwell was a brilliant storyteller. We're here with all the evidence. If we can get to be 10% as good, we got to be better than 1% or 10% better storytellers to get that across and operate the leadership team to help our CEOs get through the BS into crossing this difficult journey which we're all on.
It is mind-boggling to me how one isolated data point from one survey. I this is kind of something that I've been telling a lot through the perspective of data literacy. One survey, one data point, and a handful of incredibly effective storytellers can be the genesis of a trend, yeah. Right? A hype-worthy thing, a shiny object that makes us look over here. Whether I'm not saying this is always the case, but there are plenty of trends, there are plenty of hype stories in our space. And the story that you're telling is circle back to value, business value, measure what you are managing, be yep. a leader, be brave, be willing to take some risks, buck the status quo. The things that we've been doing aren't working. Status quo, same old, same old. These manufacturing line approaches to everything that we're doing, not working. Eddie, I love it. You're not alone. I'm telling the same stories out there. I know there are others like us that are telling these stories. Where can people reach you to get more information?
So they can reach me on LinkedIn, which is I'm Eddie Short, or LinkedIn in Eddie S. They can get me at my new venture, which is Intelligent Enterprise Partners. So I'm Eddie, E-D-D-I-E, at ie-partners.co.uk. Or they can look at our website, which is iepartners.co.uk. And if you you can also find what I'm doing on research with through Aston University, which is a UK university where I'm doing my doctoral program. You'll see my blog on LinkedIn, which is called the Intelligent Enterprise Blog. And there you'll see. So follow me on LinkedIn, drop me an email. I'm happy to basically speak to anybody and everybody about the challenges of basically, as you say, driving value and transformation in the world of an AI-powered, data-enabled world.
Wonderful. Good stuff. Eddie, thank you so much for your time. We are on the cusp of a bank holiday long weekend for the UK and Memorial Day here in the US. So happy long weekend to us all. Of course, this episode will air long after that, but we're all in good moods because of the weekend coming. Thank you so much for your time. Really appreciate it. Your insights, awesome stuff. To all of our listeners, if you are not subscribed to the CDO Matters podcast, we'd be thrilled if you joined our growing community of data practitioners, data leaders, data managers, data stewards, data governors, you name it. Please subscribe. We will check you out on another episode of CDO Matters podcast sometime very, very soon. Thanks, all. Thanks, Eddie.
Thank you. Bye. Thank you, Malcolm.